The death toll from a suicide bombing at a crowded mosque in Pakistan's Peshawar has risen to 47. One more Palestinian man is killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Tehran summons Ukraine chargé d'affaires to protest the senior Ukraine official's remarks about a drone attack in the Iranian city of Isfahan. News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. The death toll from a suicide bombing at a crowded mosque in the northwestern Pakistani city of Peshawar has risen to 47. According to government officials, some 150 people also got wounded in that explosion that ripped through the mosque close to the police headquarters. Many of the casualties are from among police officers who gathered there for noon prayers. An entire wall of the mosque and its roof were blown out, burying a number of policemen under the rubble. A militant group known as Tehrik-e-Taliban in Pakistan has claimed responsibility. Peshawar, that borders Afghanistan, is frequently targeted by that group. The Pakistani Taliban have stepped up attacks since ending a peace deal with Islamabad last year. Authorities have put security forces on high alert in the wake of the explosion. Our Islamabad correspondent Nasser Kazmi joined us a little while ago for some details on the Peshawar blast. Let's take a listen.
Tehrik-e-Taliban, Pakistan, has claimed the responsibility of the attack. We have seen that the government has been engaged with the talks with this outlawed group, Tehrik-e-Taliban, Pakistan, in recent years, and more than 17 accords were signed between Pakistani government and the TTP, but there were no fruitful results of those ceasefires. And 3 months ago, this outlawed group again ended the ceasefire and started carrying out attacks in all across Pakistan, especially in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, at the same time in southwestern Balochistan province. So at the moment, the government is trying to control the situation, but we have seen that Peshawar and its adjacent areas came under terrorist attacks in recent months. So the Prime Minister of Pakistan has appealed the nation to donate bloods for those who are in dire need of blood in the hospitals to save their lives at the moment.
Now, Palestinians have held a funeral for a young man killed by Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 26-year-old Naif Salman Abu Foda was shot in the head at the entrance of Al-Khalil. The shooting came just days after regime forces launched a deadly raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank. The incursion left 10 people dead and dozens more injured. Israel has stepped up crackdown across the occupied territories. 35 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this month. A correspondent, Amala Mona Kandil, has some more details regarding the killing of the young Palestinian in Al-Khalil.
Circumstances of killing yet another Palestinian in Al-Khalil this time, it's not clear. What we know is that a 26-year-old Nassim Abu Foda arrived at the Israeli military checkpoint known as 160. It's south Al-Ibrahimi, Al-Haram Al-Ibrahimi, in the city of Al-Khalil. He arrived there and Israeli forces opened fire. They shot him directly in the head. He was transferred to hospital and immediately he died in the Palestinian hospital in Al-Khalil. The Israeli military didn't issue any statements yet to say, as usual, that a Palestinian tried to carry out an anti-Israeli operation or to stab Israeli soldiers or to shoot Israeli soldiers. As usual, many justifications and excuses. What we received is that a Palestinian man arrived at a military checkpoint and he was shot dead.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a series of punitive measures against Palestinians in response to the Friday shooting in Al-Quds that led to the death of seven Israelis. It wounded several others. The measures include moves to expand settlements in the occupied territories. Our correspondent has more from Ramallah.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a series of punitive steps against Palestinians in response to Friday's shooting in East Al-Quds. The operation, which was carried out by 21-year-old Khayr Alqam from East Al-Quds, killed seven Israeli settlers and wounded several others. The steps announced late on Saturday during a meeting of the Israeli cabinet included new moves to expand Jewish settlements. The cabinet, however, has not provided details on how settlements would be expanded. Other measures include granting gun permits to Israelis, a move seen as a green light to Israeli civilians' use of guns against Palestinians.
These are parts of more collective punishment, more aggression and crimes against Palestinians. They are speaking about home demolitions and stripping citizenship of the families of those who carry out such operations from the real owners of the land, and more such moves against the people of Al-Quds.
The cabinet also decided more punishments for the families of those who carry out shooting operations by deciding to demolish their homes. Early on Sunday, Israeli troops raided Attur neighborhood where martyr Khayr Alqam came from and sealed up the entrances of his family home in preparation for its demolition. The Israeli cabinet voted to revoke residency and citizenship rights of families of those who carry out shooting operations from Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
Friday's operation came only one day after Israeli forces shot dead nine Palestinians during a raid on a refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. That brings to more than 30 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of this year. Observers argue that the Israelis themselves should be now worried about the repercussions of the right-wing regime's policies, including the deadly raid on Jenin. They add that the Palestinians won't fear Netanyahu's further restrictions and collective punishment they already are used to under Tel Aviv's occupation. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Tehran slams this foolish and biased and anti-Iran analogy by the German chancellor, saying that it shows that Olaf Scholz is standing on the wrong side of history. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says there is, however, historical similarity between extremism in Germany now and the failures of that country's leaders prior to the Second World War. Nasser Kanani says that the promotion of violence and hatred is the outcome of both cases. He said that some people are using human rights as a means of painting a positive picture of themselves. He then criticized the German silence on Israeli crimes and brutality. During a visit to Argentina on Sunday, Scholz drew a parallel between the dictatorship in the late 20th century and Iran's response to the recent riots in the country. Tehran has summoned Ukraine chargé d'affaires in reaction to Kiev's comments about a foiled drone attack in Iran. The move came after a senior Ukrainian presidential aide implied the role of his country in the incident and linked it to the war in Ukraine. Iran's defense ministry on Saturday successfully repelled a drone attack on a workshop in the central city of Isfahan. The attack did not cause any loss of life or disruption to the workshop's operations. The Russian defense ministry says that its troops have made more advances in the eastern Donbas region, inflicting losses on Ukrainian forces there.
In the South Donetsk and Zaporizhia directions, units of the Eastern Group of Forces continuing successful offensive operations took more advantageous positions and inflicted a defeat in the combat on units of the 1st Tank Brigade of the Armed Forces of Ukraine in the area of the settlement of Vugledar of the Donetsk People's Republic.
Russian installed officials in the region also confirmed earlier that Russian forces were advancing near Vugledar, a town in Donetsk region, which has been the epicenter of fighting in recent months. Russian officials made similar statements about ongoing battles for the town of Bakhmut, but they said it was too early to talk about besieging the town. Ukraine's president previously described the situation on the front lines as very tough. Volodymyr Zelensky said the people of Bakhmut, Vagledar, and other areas in Donetsk are under constant Russian attacks. Donetsk, Kherson, Zaporizhia, and Luhansk voted overwhelmingly to secede from Ukraine and join the Russian Federation in the course of referendums in September last year. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has fired the chairman of the ruling Conservative Party after his advisor concluded that Nadeem Zahawi breached a ministerial code over tax affairs. The dismissal puts under the spotlight the fact how UK ministers over the years have put their interests above those of national interests.
While the British public is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis, the dismissal of a high-ranking Tory official has added insult to the injury of millions of Britons. That after it emerged that chairman of the Conservative Party, Nadeem Zahawi, paid a penalty to HM Revenue and Customs over previously unpaid tax as part of a multi-million pound dispute while he was Chancellor. HM Revenue and Customs is a non-ministerial department of the UK government responsible for collecting taxes. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was quick to react to save his party from yet another scandal. He fired Zahawi for what he called serious breaches of the ministerial code over his tax affairs. An investigation by Sunak's ethics advisor concluded that Zahawi had broken the rules by repeatedly failing to declare an HMRC probe into his tax affairs. The dispute concluded with a £5 million settlement, including a penalty. But on Sunday, Sunak sent a letter to Zahawi saying his ethic advisor had concluded there was, quote, a serious breach of the ministerial code. In the letter, Sunak also announced his removal from the post. The dismissal came as Sunak was under fire himself for initially standing by Zahawi before ordering an internal investigation. But the Premier defended his stance, arguing that integrity in politics was the reason he did not sack the Tory chairman in time.
I think that's the right thing to do, to ensure that we have integrity in politics, but to do that in a professional way, that's what we're doing.
But many Britons remain unsatisfied with Sunak's handling of the issue. They reason out that the Prime Minister, who acted within hours over his advisor's report, should have sacked Zahawi earlier.
Well, Nadeem Zahawi obviously should be thinking about his future, but I think the bigger question here is why the Prime Minister didn't act earlier, what he knew about this situation, and why he seems to be continuously putting the interests of his party above those of his country. He knew there were allegations about Zahawi for a long time. He then knew that Zahawi had been negotiating a deal with HMRC at the same time as he was in charge of HMRC as the Chancellor. So I think the biggest question today isn't actually for Zahawi, it's actually for the Prime Minister.
Sunak also faces scrutiny over whether he knew about the minister's tax affairs and when he was told there could be a reputational risk to the government after Zahawi's appointment in October. Now many, including former high-ranking officials, suggest that Sunak's premiership risks being brought down by scandals swirling around the Tories. One such is high-stakes parliamentary inquiry into whether Sunak's predecessor Boris Johnson misled lawmakers over Partygate.
Well, dismissal comes at a time when the UK is grappling with an unprecedented cost-of-living crisis. The record high inflation has prompted workers from different sectors to stage mass walkouts in recent weeks. They demand better working conditions and wages in line with inflation.
The sacking of Nadeem Zahawi comes as Sunak's government facing decades-high inflation and a wave of public sector strike while trailing badly in opinion polls ahead of an expected 2024 election. To many, the tax evasion of Zahawi has not come as a surprise. But for a prime minister who promised accountability, professionalism and integrity while taking office, this is just a disgrace. But what happens when governments, especially in so-called first-world countries, are submerged in corruption? Many argue that politics in those countries are too chaotic to the point where things get out of hand, like what happened in the case of Zahawi. So the ironic situation is when a man briefly in charge of the Treasury does not pay taxes himself while insisting that others must pay. Apart from that, the UK is already grappling with a cost of living crisis which has been unprecedented in a century. This, coupled with the skyrocketing inflation, have so far prompted hundreds of thousands of workers from various sectors, including railway, postal, dock, energy and medical, to stage walkouts over pay and working conditions. While workers' union accused the government of inaction and called for talks to resolve the disputes, workers want their pay in line with the inflation that is currently at the level of nearly 11%. The UK is also facing rampant food and energy costs. Some even struggle to make ends meet or even afford to put food on the table.
There's people around here who can't afford to put clothes on their kids' backs or food on their table, and that he has mistakenly missed an error.
Charities are stocking up duvets, sleeping bags, hot water bottles, and blankets because they know that people can't afford to heat their homes anymore. That puts in the spotlight the number of governments which one after another took the helm at number 10 and attempted to resolve the cost of living crisis, but to no avail. The much bigger question is that how can the Sunak government run the country when it is unable to cope with this and other crises happening over there?
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, As'aluka bihaqqika wa qudsika wa azami sifatika wa asma'ik. أن تجعل أوقاتي من الليل والنهار بذكرك معمورا وبخدمتك موصولا وأعمالي عندك مقبولا حتى تكون أعمالي وأورادي كلها وردا واحدا وحالي في خدمتك سرمدا.
Dear listeners, we were discussing this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication. Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, my Lord, my Lord, my Lord. As'aluka bihaqqika wa qudsika wa a'zami sifatik. I ask you by your truth, by your holiness, and the greatness of your attributes and names. أن تجعل أوقاتي من الليل والنهار بذكرك معمورة. That you make my times in the night and the day inhabited by your remembrance. وبخدمتك موصولة. And joined to your service. وأعمالي عندك مقبولة. And my acts acceptable to you. حتى تكون أعمالي وأورادي كلها وردا واحدة. So that my acts and my prayers may all be single litany. وحالي في خدمتك سرمدا. And my occupation with your service everlasting. We were discussing the conditions of acceptance of our supplications, specifically our deeds. And one of the most important conditions was the sincerity in our actions and in our hub and bughd. This sincerity is so important that our traditions are replete with instances of the infallibles supplicating to the Lord, mentioning different aspects of sincerity in the love of Allah and its place, which is qalb, or the heart. About this, we were addressing one important question. We said that this meaning, this implication we explained, seems to be in contrast with the nature of human beings, this meaning of sincerity that we brought forth. But we said that sincerity in love of Allah does not mean rejection of human fitrah, and it means rather directing one's love according to what Allah likes and dislikes. So, sincerity in the love of Allah does not result in the destruction of human nature. It does not cause any disturbance in it. Rather, it entails a somehow reconstruction, remaking of the structure of love and hatred in human life based on this new criterion, which is beautifully presented by Islam. Accordingly, the natural love and inclination of man remains intact, but within a new arrangement. And for this very reason, there has been enormous emphasis in the Islamic narrations on the value of love of Allah for Allah. For instance, Imam Ali alayhi salam is narrated to have said, "Love Allah, for Allah is the closest kinship." He is also reported to have said, "Love of Allah is much stronger than the womb relation."
Beseech you by your glory and honor, by your supremely high attributes, and by your names, to cause me to utilize my time day and night in your remembrance by engaging myself in serving you, and to let my deeds be acceptable to you, so much so that all my actions and offerings may be transformed into one continuous and sustained effort, and my life may take the form of constant and perpetual service to you, O my Master, O you upon whom I rely, O you unto whom I express my distress.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever, the feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
These expressions of the Ahlul Bayt and Imam Ali alayhi salam are precise, and they depend on an important intellectual principle. There is indeed a diversity of blood relationships and close ties in the lives of people. The firmest of these relations is the womb relation. Now, according to this tradition of Imam Ali alayhi salam, that says love of Allah is much stronger than the womb relation, the relation with Allah is much stronger even than the womb relation. So, If a person ties his love and attachment to this relation, if he succeeds in organizing his love and hatred based on it, then all his relations would become the strongest and the most perfect of relations. The reason they would become the firmest of relations is that if a relation is for the sake of other than Allah, then it is susceptible to change and upheaval, as it can be affected with things which can alter the attitude of a person toward the other. But if the love of the person for his brother in faith is for the sake of Allah, then it would be firm and strong and more enduring in the face of different conflicting elements and factors. So this is how important this sincerity of love is. This is reflected in our tradition sometimes under the title of loving Allah for the Almighty Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Economic divide.
The U.S. is in a recession. The U.S. is not in a recession. The U.S. will be in a recession. So, what is the deal? Well, some say that it is already, others say that it will be in this year, 2023, and then some others are predicting a soft landing. So which one of these scenarios will be the case? That's what we're going to find out in this edition of Economic Divide, because the U.S. economy going into a recession does matter for its impact on the world economy. Some of the highlights of this program coming up is the U.S. recession for the year 2023. The odds, 70% demand forecasts have been slashed and inflation projections have been trimmed. All the signs that the U.S. will be in a recession for the year 2023. Some of the highlights there of that particular topic. Then we move on to GDP growth, another highlight. It's been said to average a paltry 0.3% only. Consumer spending will barely grow, and that accounts for 2/3 of the GDP in the U.S. Don't forget that. And another highlight coming up in this program, recession factors that we called it. Well, you have surging interest rates, you have high inflation, another sign of recession, and also the end of fiscal stimulus and weak export markets all contribute to recession.
The U.S. economy is going through a tough time. Economists say there is a 7 in 10 likelihood that the U.S. economy will sink into a recession this year. There are now worries that the economy may be heading towards a more pronounced slowdown. According to surveys, the recession probability was up from 65% in November and has more than doubled over the last 6 months. That's mainly due to last year's aggressive rate hikes by the Federal Reserve. Analysts believe several factors are involved here: surging interest rates, high inflation, the end of fiscal stimulus, and weak export markets abroad have all contributed to the weakening of the U.S. economy. Officials at the Federal Reserve say that they will hike rates more than they initially expected over time. That is because officials want to tame the rising levels of inflation. Inflation readings from the UK and the Eurozone also factored into fears of an economic slowdown. Meanwhile, released data show that US retail sales fell by the most in a year in December, pulled down by declines in purchases of motor vehicles and a range of other goods. That puts consumer spending and the overall economy on a weaker growth path heading into 2023. Now that 2023 is here, it remains to be seen when the recession is actually going to hit.
We are seeing a slowing in the economy and in demand that's appropriate and necessary to transition from rapid growth and recovery from a serious job shortfall to now a very strong labor market. We need to see a slowdown in growth. We are seeing that. I do believe there's a path by which we maintain a strong labor market like that.
It's time now for the social media posts of this program. I'm not going to lie to you. Practically most of the posts that we went through, almost every other one, said that the U.S. was in a recession by the end of 2022 and that for the year 2023 it will definitely be in one. So let's get started. First post: in the U.S., high inflation and aggressively hiking interest rates caused looming recession in 2022. What will the economy be like in 2023? The Economist warns the risk of a recession in the U.S. Economy will be high. Next up, a 60-40 portfolio of U.S. stocks and bonds in 2022 would have yielded the worst performance in a century. The U.S. will have a huge recession in 2023. Americans are so clueless, though, supporting a proxy war against Russia. Next post: every U.S. recession has been preceded by at least one of the following: oil shock, inverted yield curve, Fed tightening cycle. The year 2022 had all three. Then, the six-month rate of change of the leading economic index has a perfect track record of forecasting recessions. Says the LEI indicator tells us that a recession is right here, right now. And then finally, in answer to the previous tweet, we picked this one, which said we met the definition of a recession after the first two quarters. Our energy exports are the main driving force behind a positive third quarter. We are in a recession, but it is being masked. Okay, so it's being masked. Let's find out what our guest thinks about this. Let me see who we have. We have David Hungerford, an author and economist, who joins us as a first guest here on Economic Divide. David Hungerford, welcome to the program. So, let's take a look at the prediction, 70% prediction that the U.S. will experience a full recession for the year 2023. Economists are predicting a 70% chance of that happening. That's according to the latest survey that Bloomberg gave out. Do you agree with Bloomberg? Do you think that based on the stats, the U.S. will be in a recession for the year 2023?
How are we doing? Okay, well, the United States already is in a recession. It's been fobbed off as a pandemic. But in fact, you know, the United States went into a rather serious recession in Q1 2020. And at that time, the cause was an enormous overburden of household debt, you know, mortgages, student debt, credit card loans, car loans. It was over $16 trillion, which comes out to, you know, around, you know, $200,000 of debt, household debt per family in the United States. Roughly speaking, you know, whereas the median household gross income is only $69,000. And it's simply impossible to carry, you know, $200,000 of debt against, you know, gross income of $69,000.
All right. Let me introduce our next guest. We have Robert Bruska, who joins us. He is a chief economist at Fact and Opinion Economist. Robert Bruska, welcome to Economic Divide. The median estimates see gross domestic product averaging just 0.3% next year, which includes a annualized 0.7% decline in terms of the figures we have for the second quarter. And then you have flat readings for the first and third quarters. Consumer spending, which accounts for about two-thirds of the GDP, that's a huge chunk, is projected to barely grow in the middle half of the year, this year that we're in. Why would the U.S., the world's alleged number one economy, experience such paltry numbers?
Yeah, I think a recession is coming. I think the percentages are, you know, roughly what you'd expect from economists at this point. Some of the early data, even over this past week, have been quite disturbing, with personal consumption expenditures declining for the second month in a row, and with an extremely weak reading out of the Fed survey for manufacturing in the New York region, and another relatively weak one out of the Philadelphia region. It looks like the economy is headed for recession. But so far, it's also true that it has not affected the job market. The unemployment rate remains at a cycle low. Jobless claims this last week went down about 200,000, which is an extremely low level. And so we continue to get very mixed signals on the economy. Some things saying that the economy is getting very weak, and other things saying the economy is almost unaffected.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program. This section obviously is dedicated to news that we gather from around the world that we deem to be important. We pick four of them. First off, in a subject that is somewhat related to this program, not somewhat, it is very much related to this program, and it's about layoffs in the United States, and in particular, tech layoffs. Tech for technology, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and other tech companies have laid off more than 70,000 employees for the last year. Layoffs come as tech companies are cutting back on spending, and also rising inflation is curbing consumer spending. So this particular topic, just so you know, is so vast in its impact, we decided to actually dedicate a program to it, which will be coming up probably in a couple weeks' time, so do watch out for that. Taking a look now at the next topic, EU-China relations. In particular, we're looking at a stance that France actually took when it comes to China, where he said China cannot be out, China must be in. France is saying that it's diverging with the U.S. on ties with Beijing. The United States has taken a confrontational approach, how France sees it, and a lot of other people in countries. Well, the EU has looked at striking a balance when it comes to China. The French President Emmanuel Macron has said, we don't want to oppose China, we want to engage with China. We want China to obey by the same rules. I'll have to wait and see how that pans out, but it looks like the EU wants to obviously keep that relationship going. The topic that comes up next is something that we have focused on quite a bit. It's called de-dollarization, and this comes from Saudi Arabia, where it said they are now open to the idea of trading in currencies besides the U.S. dollar. And the headline read, does this spell doom for the greenback? Because it's the first time in 48 years that Saudi Arabia has said something like that. Now, Saudi Arabia's comments are the latest signal that powerful nations across the world are actually moving ahead, maybe based on this particular piece of news that says it's plotting. Well, countries are moving ahead with a de-dollarization of the global economy. I'm not too sure plotting would be the word, because if it is, then it shows that this has been in the works for quite some time, which is very well possible. And finally, our topic comes out of the U.S., where there have been lots of bankruptcies that have been reported, U.S. lender bankruptcies in particular, where lenders are starting to go bankrupt with the new mortgages, which is a signal, now down 47%. And the question now arises, could this one factor trigger the worst surge of failures since the 2008 financial crisis? You have new mortgages that were down 47% in the third quarter of 2022 compared to the year before. And that is the biggest annual drop in 21 years. Those four topics were what we picked for this section of our program called InfoNews. Please do send us your ideas or topics related to the economy. We would appreciate it very much.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section of the program. Now, in this section, we need to take a look at the U.S. economy in terms of different factors that we deemed important relative to other economies around the world, which is another focus of this in-depth section, but also as to why we are saying that the possibility of a recession is actually here for the U.S., especially in this new year. Now, first up, let's take a look at recessions in the U.S. That have happened in the past. I mean, it's worth taking a look at these recessions and how long they lasted in the U.S. Now, according to how we define a recession, the U.S. did experience a recession back in the year 2022, last year, since it experienced two consecutive quarters of GDP contraction. Now, in February of 2020, and of course, the relative times. Next, in terms of the recession for the year 2023, now, this is why we even came up with this program. Economists are saying that there is a 7 in 10 likelihood that the U.S. economy will sink into a recession for this year. From June until now, the odds of the U.S. will be in a recession have grown. This is for the year 2022 in terms of the surveys that they took, and that month after month has increased. Now, because of this projection, obviously it has had its ripple effects. For example, CEOs, they have been on the move. About 39% of the CEOs have actually implemented a hiring freeze, while 46%, they are considering downsizing their employee base during the next 6 months. So for the next 6 months of this year, that's what's going to be happening. Now, another estimate that we took a look at is a gross domestic product. Well, for the U.S., it's averaging a paltry 0.3% next year based on the projections that have been made. That includes an annualized 0.7% decline in the second quarter and also flat readings in the first and third quarters. So things are not looking that great based on those indicators. Now, in the meantime, consumer spending, that's important to take a look at. Consumer spending accounts for about 2/3 of the U.S. GDP. That is projected to barely grow. And when it's going to grow? Well, the projection is in the middle half of this year, so another 6 months to go. And then finally, here are some raw indicators visualized in one lump sum. U.S. savings, the lowest since the year 2008, 4.4%. It has decreased. Crypto losses, $2 trillion. Ouch, that hurts. Taking a look at credit card debt at 20%, you're looking at about $1 trillion for U.S. households. I think that averages roughly about $200,000 per household or so. Then inflation standing at 10% as of now, and then mortgage rates, which have doubled. Let's find out what our guests think about this. First up, we'll bring back David Hungerford. He's an author and economist. David Hungerford, welcome back to Economic Divide. So we just went over some indicators for the U.S., but really the U.S. is facing big headwinds when you take a look at interest rates, high inflation, the end of fiscal stimulus, weak export markets abroad, just some. Businesses have turned cautious about adding inventories and also about their hiring. When do you think things are going to turn around for the U.S.?
I don't think any end is in sight. The economic difficulties that you mentioned are by no means confined to the United States. I think every developed industrial economy in the world is in this shape. I think China's in terrible shape also. They've had these lockdowns, lockdowns always stand for keeping people under control in the face of economic crisis. So you have, we're looking at something that's very widespread around the world. And at this point, I would say that no end is in sight.
All right. Very well. Thank you for that. Let me now bring back our guest, Robert Bruska, who's the chief economist, the fact and opinion economist, who rejoins us. Robert Bruska, welcome back. The U.S. economy is facing a whole lot of challenges. Interest rates is one of them. You have high inflation, which is still not seen cooling down, even though there have been some signs that it is. But the end of fiscal stimulus is set to be another problem. And, of course, the exports. I mean, you have countries that rely on U.S. exports, and that's not happening from the U.S. based on factory production declining also. When do you think things are going to turn around for the U.S.?
Right. Well, these are all the classic symptoms that you have or characteristics that you have as the economy goes into recession and spends time in recession. And, you know, nobody ever knows how long a recession is going to be. You know, an average recession is probably something less than a year. We've had them much longer than that. How long this one is depends on how the Fed chooses to fight inflation. There are some people at the Fed who want the Fed to raise interest rates more sharply and to push inflation back down relatively quickly. However, there are other people who think that the Fed needs to slow down to keep interest rates about where they are, and then to hold interest rates at the level that they are now for a longer period of time and to slowly grind inflation down. So the grind inflation down path will be one that will cause the economy to underperform for a longer period of time. If we have higher interest rates in the near term, it's more likely that we'll have a somewhat sharper recession and that we will reduce inflation more quickly.
Retail sales have plummeted 1.1% last month, which marked the biggest drop since December 2021. The Fed's Beige Book report, which was released, described consumer spending as increasing slightly. High inflation continued to reduce consumers' purchasing power, particularly among low and moderate income households. Sales at auto dealers fell 1.2%. Receipts at service stations tumbled 4.6%. Online retail sales dropped 1.1%. The Fed last year raised its policy rate by 425 basis points from near zero to a 4.25% to 4.50% range. That is the highest since late 2007. A separate report from the Fed showed manufacturing output dropped 1.3% in December. This was the largest decline since February 2021. Most economists expect the economy will slip into a recession by the second half of this year.
As shown in our summary of economic projections, the median projection for real GDP growth stands at just 0.5% this year and next, well below the median estimate of the longer-run normal growth rate. Despite the slowdown in growth, the labor market remains extremely tight, with the unemployment rate near a 50-year low. Job vacancies still very high, and wage growth elevated.
But some hope that moderating inflation could discourage the Fed to stop raising interest rates. U.S. inflation rate is at 6.45% compared to 7.11% last month and 7.04% last year. This is higher than the long-term average of 3.27%.
When it comes to the U.S. economy, given its size first, then its integration with the world financial system, it is obvious that a recession there will impact the entire world. Yet, it would be premature to talk about its impact without looking at the world as a whole. If the U.S. dips into a long period of sluggish growth, emerging markets are going to struggle. Major exporters to the U.S., such as China, Mexico, and Canada, would feel pain if U.S. demand weakened for a prolonged period of time. Meanwhile, the warning signs are there that the U.S. can't avoid a recession because the global economy is not doing that well either. The World Bank has warned global economy could tip into recession in 2023. It has slashed its 2023 growth forecasts to levels teetering on the brink of recession for many countries. It cited the impact of central bank rate hikes to tame inflation as the reason, along with the Ukraine conflict. In its previous Global Economic Prospects report in June 2022, the bank had forecast 2023 global growth at 3%. Another world financial institution, the IMF, has also forecast a global recession, but the forecast was gloomier and more dire than other projections. It said not only would half of the European Union be in a recession, one-third of the world would face recession in 2023. It said that the main engines of global growth, the United States, Europe, and China, are experiencing weakened activity. This graph points to the growth or lack of it by these countries that accumulate the most sales and are the engines of world growth. The US stood at 0.5%, the euro area at no growth, flat, and China's growth to be 4.4%. The previous world growth is also cited here to put things into perspective. The International Monetary Fund also said that a severe fragmentation of the global economy could reduce global economic output by up to 7% after decades of increasing economic integration. It added that the losses could reach 8 to 12% in some countries if technology is also decoupled. And finally, to round off our dismal and gloomy outlook, there is another factor that poses the biggest threat or risk for the world, as if our previous facts were not enough. A World Economic Forum survey of global risk specialists found that failure to tackle climate change and environmental degradation dominate the ranking of top risks facing the planet over the next decade. It concludes that current-day challenges, including the rising cost of living, persistent energy and food supply crunches, and heavy national debts, threaten to thwart the collective will and cooperation needed to address such problems. Okay, that's the end of this segment of the program.
We've reached the end of the program, so after all of this, is the U.S. in a recession or not? Well, as of Monday, January 23, Reuters reported that U.S. manufacturers probably entered a recession in the fourth quarter of 2022. But when you have massive layoffs happening, like in the tech sector that we mentioned before, rising interest rates, which, well, slows down purchasing from homes to essential items, with stock markets losing ground after disappointing sales records that they had, U.S. data on corporate earnings, well, that all points to the fact that the U.S. will be in a recession, if it's not already, for the year 2023. So the recession will be there. Thanks so much for tuning in to this edition of Economic Divide. It was great having you with us. I hope you enjoyed it. From Yikovi Tahoe and the team, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.